Hello, and welcome back to For the Medical Record, a podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Center for the Medical Humanities and Social Medicine. We are your hosts, Mia Levinson.
I'm Richard Del Rio.
And we're so excited for our guest today. We have Lan Lee, an assistant professor here at Johns Hopkins at our very own Institute for the History of Medicine. They're also the director for the online program in the History of Medicine. Lan is here to talk to us about their new book, fresh out from Johns Hopkins University Press, Body Maps, Improvising Meridians and Nerves in Global Chinese Medicine.
This is going to be an interesting book to talk about because throughout human history, our search for progress and knowledge in the fields of medicine and science has oftentimes required us to look for what couldn't be seen with our physical senses and to create images to explain them to others. Whether those explanations were grounded in spirits or metaphysical energies, microbes or new proteins, for example. I think that this is really a relevant point today in consideration of how much weight we put into imaging of the human brain and the larger meanings we attribute to these depictions for the people whose brains are being scanned. This week, we're going to continue our global history trend with Chinese medicine utilized in the treatment of neuropathy. We will try to explore these unseen forces or channels called Jinglu that are claimed to affect our experience of sensation and offer another perspective on the idea of our minds as experienced, embodied, but nevertheless unseen things.
And because podcasting is an auditory medium, we wanted to give you a sense of what these anatomical illustrations that Lan will be talking to us about look like. So, in the preface of the book, there is a line drawing of the upper half of a human body drawn out in black ink. It's quite a busy image. There are circular points located around the body. Connecting these points are parallel lines, like paths going from point to point, sometimes crisscrossing or branching out into multiple points. These parallel lines represent the 12 primary meridians. All in all, it kind of looks like a subway map, where you have marginalia in Chinese characters to the sides of these points, to the side of the figure itself, serving as kind of a legend to understand this body map. So with that in mind, we'll jump into our conversation with Lan. Welcome to the podcast, Lan.
Hello, hello. Hi. Thanks for having me again.
Of course. Yeah. I was going to say, you're For the Medical Record's first repeat guest. Congratulations.
That's wild.
Very first time we've had a repeat guest. You know, I was re-listening to the episode you did back with Christy and Antoine in 2022. And you're talking a little bit about your book project and the podcast. So that was 3 years ago. Now the book is out, it's published. How has your thinking about body maps changed or evolved since then? Are there any new resonances that you're seeing or feeling with this material that you've been looking at for all these years?
When you sent the questions, I was thinking a lot about what's changed in the last 3 years. And the kind of 3 years is a bit arbitrary. I didn't know then that I would come back now. And a lot has changed in the sense that having the physical book forces me to engage with the social world in a different way, completely different way. Now there's an object that I can offer as a gift. It's my gift back to the people who have helped me think through a lot of these questions. And I mean, I dedicated the book to my family because it was, I started this project because I wanted to, in my junior senior year of college, I wanted to have a project that allowed me to see my grandparents in Beijing. So my mom was like, you could just look at integrative medicine. And so much of my early academic training was in biomedicine. And a lot of it was very Eurocentric. And I didn't have very clear models of what looking at global histories of medicine or integrative medicine or Asian medicine, I didn't have models at the time. And this was 2006 to 2010. There were books that came out, like Shigehisa's Expressiveness of the Body was already out. There are lots of books in religion that have been out. I'm sitting next to Michael Strickman's book, Chinese Magical Medicine. And so a lot of the things that I'm reading now are part of this, I guess now, a lifelong journey. So it's not just the last 3 years, but it's definitely it definitely is a huge shift, a huge change.
Maybe we should get into the book, you know, about what it's about. I find it interesting that this book about global Chinese medicine opens up with an anecdote in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And you are interviewing a practitioner of acupuncture, and as well as, excuse me, but it's hard for me to pronounce the term. If you could.
Moxibustion.
Moxibustion. Thank you. So what I found really interesting, right, is that the title of the book, right, is about global Chinese medicine. But you make the point that there is no single Chinese medicine, but rather many kinds around the world. And you say you're describing a history before Chinese medicine was Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that, and then and also speak to what particular aspects of Chinese medicine this book focuses on?
Mm-mm. Yeah. So it's funny because you see Chinese in the title, Chinese medicine in the title. You see me completely taking it apart in the introduction. And then for the rest of the book, I don't return to it ever again. It's a way in because I need to have a starting point for my readers. People would be interested in acupuncture and moxibustion. Maybe people have had acupuncture before, or maybe they're vaguely aware of whatever Chinese medicine is. And for a lot of my career, I've been working to offer a different way of thinking and talking about this cosmology, this practice, assuming that it's so discrete, because it's not. The classic history of modern Chinese medicine is that traditional Chinese medicine was invented in the 1950s with the rise of the Chinese Communist Party. Sean Lay has written about how in the 1930s, members of in the nationalist government were trying to regulate Chinese medicine and named it for the first time by naming it. All these practitioners who were very local, who had lots of family lineages and had a huge diversity of diagnosis and therapeutics, they came together for the first time because they had to be regulated or because they were responding to the attempt to regulate. And ever since then, the institutionalization has created the Chineseness of Chinese medicine. And we can talk about tariffs if you want, but even accessing some of these herbs, some of them are grown in like Madison, Wisconsin. Some of them are grown in parts of East Africa. So whatever this global marketplace, it has been global for a very long time. But the branding, the nationalist branding, is somewhat new in the larger scheme of things.
I think this gets to the heart of the word global in your title. Some of the forms of medical practices you're talking about may often be used in China or may have originated in China, but mm-hmm. that they have these practices that are sort of all across the world. And you are specifically talking about these anatomical illustrations, which you refer to as meridians, right? These kind of like nerve, correct me if I'm completely off, but these kind of like nerve-centric images that are using sort of like lines to essentially graph out different understandings of the nervous system.
Well, some people say that it's nerves, but the argument of the book is that it's actually the way that it treats nerves is that it shows how nerves are actually an unstable model of modernity. And nerves are actually, and one of her questions was about improvisation, but nerves, the images of neuroanatomy is actually more improvisatory than meridian tool, these charts of meridian paths, which represent channels in the body called jingluo and jingmai. So some people say it's nerve-centric, but when you actually get to what nerves are and what they represent and how they manifest in the body, it's all up in the air. It's wild. It's wild how unstable they are and how hard it is to really pin nerves down in a way that it's not. It's almost more intuitive to pin meridians down for practitioners, but nerves serve as a larger metaphor.
Thank you for elaborating on that. The thing I'm interested in with this kind of idea of a global form of medicine, right, is the way that you're tracking the way that they're moving across time and across space. And I'm curious for you, like, why have these images in particular lived on in practitioners' clinics, among other spaces, for so long, for these sort of centuries that you're walking us through this book?
A lot of the practitioners I talk to, they say that it's useful to, as a kind of heuristic, to talk about meridians, but they don't really use it in their own practice. They use it to teach, but not actively in their own practice. So I suspect that the images matter more to the image makers. What they actually mean, the book doesn't get into, but I suspect because I've seen these images appear in woodcuts or appear as woodcuts, engravings, sometimes they're drawn by hand with a brush. I've tried to reconstruct them myself. They hang in my office. And the images are interesting because they're actually not just used for needling and heating. Moxibustion is burning moxa dust, mugwort, on your skin at a high temperature. So these images aren't just for that. You can actually access them through meditation, qigong practices, through herbs. You can access them both externally and internally. But the way that I present meridians is that I actually make them interactive and I map my own out. And when you map them out, they have discrete links. They all connect. They are associated with specific parts of the body. And the more that I think about meridians, the more like amazing they are, because they extend the length of the body. They're actually much longer than your body, and they sink and they rise and they wiggle around. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that they also are meant to radiate outside the body too. They're kind of like antennae. So if you ever have the experience of being in an acupuncture clinic, if your acupuncturist is like palpating a part of you or even walks by, sometimes different acupuncture points, they start to like light up. And because I know where they are, I'm like, oh, like my spleen 4 on my foot is like, you know, or my stomach 36 is like hungry. And these are contemporary names of these points. And I'm starting to get kind of technical about what these things are.
Actually,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I was hoping that we could take.
You want to get technical?
No. It gets really technical. I like getting technical. Don't get it wrong. Mm-hmm. What I would like to do, though, is before we continue on the discussion, let's hold our listeners' hands a little bit. And I think mm-hmm. a great way to do that would be for you to just give us a few descriptions of what someone would see if they were looking at a tu.
Before I get into this graphic genre of mm-hmm. a tu, it took me a while to settle on the argument of the book, which is using graphic genre as a way to not only get into histories of science historiography, but also art history and also Chinese studies. So, you know, Peter Gallis and Lauren Dastin's classic book on objectivity is such a compelling way of thinking about images. And I always wondered what is missing, what kinds of images don't fit in this history, what kinds of images and graphic genres that are also different or demand different epistemologies of the eye, what is missing here? And meridians are fascinating because they only exist as line drawings. They only exist in this graphic genre of a tu. And a tu is like, I mean, now tu can be used to describe any image, but historically it was a specific kind of technical image. Francesca Bray has edited a volume on graphics and text in China. And so this category of a tu, this, you can say that it's low tech if you want to compare it to something that's quite expensive, but it is cheaper to draw by hand. But these pads only ever appear in a tool. Even now, if you have MRIs, X-ray, CT scans, you can't see these pads in full. They only appear, all 12 pairs, 14 sets, these lines only appear in this one graphic genre. And so it's fascinating that these pads that date to archaeological figurines in antiquity, they appear as paths. They're buried with people. They appear on sculptures and they appear on paper. Some of the images that I look at, I mean, the book starts in the 10th century and that's not nearly early enough. So I start in the middle where these paths are already established. And so there are these 12 paths, these 12 pairs. There are many pairs. There are many paths in the body. They connect to the organs and they move from the heads to the hand to the feet. They are very remarkably, very consistent and persistent historically. So the 12 pairs have remained as 12 pairs. Their names have not changed for about 2,000 years. Maybe, let's say, for about at least 1,000 years. And that is really interesting. I don't mean to say that they're transhistorical in this acontextual sense, but they are remarkable because they are so stable. Meanwhile, acupuncture points have exploded. There used to be 360 classical sites. Now they're like over 3,000. And people are inventing more and more practices. So I'm interested in these paths in the body. And these are also some paths that I grew up with. Like I grew up practicing Qigong, and you imagine like the energy circulating among these paths. You can see them, you can feel them. They are corporeal, they are embodied, and they're quite easy to access if you pay attention and if you know where they are. The images themselves are have this fascinating robustness that we don't see in neuroanatomy. And yet in the 19th century, physiologists are trying to explain what these paths are. And they turn to neuroanatomy, this very imperfect, highly improvisatory set of images. And they fail over and over again. And the book is about why we fail. And it makes the argument that it's because of the images. It's because of the kind of images that they are, this graphic genre that supports these invisible paths, invisible in the sense that you can't see it with your naked eye, even though in Japanese Buddhism, the flesh eye is the lowest form of seeing. Your mind's eye is much clearer. So I'm not saying you can't see it if you like close your eyes, but I mean, I talked to practitioners who are able to sense it and feel it, and they can see it in the sense they can sense it. So I'm not trying to fetishize or reify vision, but the graphic images do something. And the book has to select these case studies, these kind of fragments, to make the argument to show what they are, what they do, why they never meet.
You use this like phrase of improvising or improvisation in the book. What really stuck out to me is when you make the comparison to jazz, right?
Mm.
For our listeners, can you explain, what do you mean when you're using the term improvisation? What are these improvisations in the imagery? And maybe a little bit about how they're shifting from creator to creator, or across time, or across space.
Mm. I was really looking forward to this question because I wanted to, I also wanted to ask what improv means to you as someone from performance studies, because it's so intersubjective. Like there's something magical about improvisation. And I am indebted to my friend, colleague, Andrew Goldman, who's a neuroscientist. So I had a postdoc in neuroscience. And he worked on the neuroscience of improvisation, novelty, creativity. And he always asked this question, what are we measuring when we're trying to measure and study creativity? Because for him, maybe improvisation was a way of knowing. And I thought about that. And I played with it myself. And I was reading the literature that he was reading. And when I looked at my own images, I was thinking about the fact that they are hand-drawn, and that they are subject to kind of flourishes of, I mean, someone could be shaking, someone could be quite skilled compared to drawing it on a computer. It's a very different experience. The flourishes that you, the accidents that happen in a hand drawing create something new that you just cannot, like with everything that's predetermined on a computer, you can't actually, you don't have the luxury of accident or accident in the same way. So drawing something like tracing a line over and over again changes the quality of that image. And so I was thinking about improvisation also maybe as a way of knowing, but also as part of the nature of these images. And I use the example of nerves or improvising nerves, or I introduce that whenever I talk about the book. I talk about how nerves are more improvised, more highly improvised than meridians, because you have so many images full of reflex arcs. You have all these, you know, like cell biology, like Krebs cycle. You have arrows everywhere. And I remember when I was in a neuroscience conference, someone stood up and said, you know, these lines are dirty. These are dirty lines. And I love that. Like this was when I was still working on the book as a postdoc. So for neuroscientists, sometimes the overabundance of lines is, it's a performance of certainty. And sometimes it forecloses the opportunity to explore what we don't know. So I think improv is, I'm calling it improv, even though I know it's not improv. It's not like intersubjective improv, but it is demanding a certain kind of, it makes the image demand something and the artist demand something.
Well, I wonder, and you brought up performance studies.
Please, so please.
I'll talk a little bit. I was actually thinking about theater.
Mm.
I was thinking about like, my studies of East Asian theater and the way that actors in styles like no theater from Japan from Beijing Opera that the movements and the gestures are very highly choreographed, and mm-hmm. actors are mm-hmm. trained for mm-hmm. years and years and years to perform like a very particular kind of choreography, a very particular kind of movement. Mm-hmm. And the great actors from these different styles come from people who, within these really highly stylized, highly codified movements, are mm-hmm. able to do something slightly mm-hmm. new mm-hmm. or different. So the kind of improvisation you're really talking about, I feel like, isn't the improvisation of like improv comedy where, mm-hmm. you know, people are shouting into an abyss and kind of seeing what sticks with an audience. and more so coming from a very like internalized, highly skilled sort of understanding of their practice, and then using that knowledge and that skill that they've built up over time to then play or explore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it is so, like, mm-hmm. I think the comparison with jazz music is so apt because it is coming from a knowledge of skill and not mm-hmm. from it's less experimentation, I feel like. It's your use of improvisation is less about experiment and more about like using all this knowledge and all the skill that you've built up to reimagine, to explore a bit.
Yeah, no, I love that you get that. No, that's, yeah, it's not shouting into the void, even though I feel like that's a lot of what we do as professors. We're like shouting and seeing what sticks. But no, it is from the amount of skill that you're describing. So the book, I think this is chapter 2, I can't remember which chapter it was, I talk a bit about math and cultures of accuracy through approximation, where you have very discrete lengths assigned to meridian paths. They total to 1,350 inches. They're very, very discrete. And yet they allow for a lot of flexibility. It's a dynamic structure, and the interaction and the use is dynamic, and you do play within that, but the knowledge is really deep. But it requires so much skill, like you said, really deep training. And the cosmology, the text, the position, the names, the lengths, they all are a form of this, they assemble this knowledge. But the use of it and the embodiment, like, that's the expression that we don't see. And the book is only this, it's just the beginning of the conversation. It took me 15 years to write a book that tries to respond to the question of why meridians are not nerves, why this whole conversation about Asian medicine not being scientific, why is that a misguided, or it sets us up for a very narrow way of thinking about bodies and about practices and about graphic genres, but it's just the beginning.
So I drew more from when in thinking about improvising, I drew more from this idea of imperfect knowledge and inaccuracy, just trying to bridge the gap between what is some kind of hidden truth and what we can describe or capture with our own senses. So we have these lines that are unseen and yet nonetheless have some kind of influence on our lived experiences, I guess, in the view of practitioners, in our health. And it's depicted in these twos, right? I don't know. Can you pluralize two by saying twos? I'm giving it a shot.
Do whatever you want. We're improvising.
Because I have imperfect knowledge of this language. Yeah, go ahead. And I'm curious to know what the purpose is of, what is the perceived purpose, and how does that purpose change over time? I know people start trying to add meaning to it, connecting meridians to nerves. But if you could walk us through these ideas of Jingmai and just help us understand, you know, because we have these unseen force, these unseen lines that we only see representations of them, whether it's on a wood carving, like in the shape of a human body, or an ink painting of a human body with all these lines going through them and annotations and marginalia describing what their influences are. I think it's very apt in comparing it to the reflex arc nervous systems, because if you see that, you'll oftentimes, you'll see, for example, of depiction of a person's finger on top of a candle, and you'll see lines, and the lines describe how the nerves are giving information. So what is the, you know, you're starting way far, pretty far in the past, but according to your own understanding of the field, the middle of the story, what is the perceived purpose or idea of Jing Lao and Jing Mai?
So I love this question about what Jing Luo and Jing Mai are for. Jing is, you can describe it as these permanent pads, these permanent channels in the body that extend from the head to the hands, through the torso to the feet. They connect to particular important viscera in the body. These are like the lungs, the heart, the kidney, liver, gallbladder, spleen, stomach, triple burner. Am I missing something? Kidneys? I say kidney already. I mean, the 5 to 6 viscera, sometimes they are in a set of 12, but they sit at the core of the body and they can be accessed. These pads can be accessed. Your health can be accessed through either taking your pulse, through diagnosis, or through therapeutic treatments. Either through, you can do needling, you can do moxa, but also you can access these pads internally with Qigong choreographies, moving choreographies, and herbs. So these pads are really robust, they're really dynamic. And in the book, I compare them to the soul and the mind, but the channels themselves are so much more. And on their own, I would say that they are forms of technologies of life. They invite certain techniques and certain practices, and they are also part of a really intricate cosmology. And here by cosmology, I don't necessarily mean like stars and moon. I mean cosmology as a really intricate, complex network of causal relationships. So you can understand why, if you're a practitioner, either someone who is, engaged in healing practices, or if you just meditate on your own, or if you're needling yourself or applying moxa on yourself, or if you're understanding, forms of stress, how your body responds to anxiety, you can understand how that might manifest in these paths that connect to different organs, and different organs can be reservoirs, they can be places where different emotions can sit, and they can also be places that receive certain kinds of injury. So emotional injury, getting yelled at, feeling stress, having really extreme worry or panic, having extreme rage, all these things manifest in the body. They can be expressed through the paths, and also they can be addressed through different forms of therapeutic practices. So there are some practitioners and some historians in our field who are trained as practitioners, because they understand how these paths manifest, they can stop a stroke when they feel it happening. Or some practitioners got into acupuncture because they watched someone else stop a heart attack. When I was in Mumbai and interviewing rural physicians who talk about accessing different points in the body to address hypertension, they'll tell you, these techniques are so robust. And if they're so robust and dynamic and effective, why don't we use them? Why don't we talk about them? So there's a bigger conversation about health and healing, but the pads themselves, I think, open up these questions. They open up questions about not just anatomy and not just about technology, but also about therapeutics and access. So they are really, in this question of what they're for so much. They're really cool. And part of the reason that I wanted to write this book was because in a lot of history of science, we have, recovering scientists who find themselves in this field, but they know so much about the actual, scientific practice already. Like, I worked in an AIDS lab before I went into history of biology. And then from history of biology, I moved into history of science in East Asia. And from history of science in East Asia, I then moved into, history of the body. So there is already a gateway. We are primed to think about systems because of STEM education, because of the world we live in. And what I'm trying to do with this book is to introduce this other world, this world that often is really densely articulated in technical books or encased in Orientalist discourses, Orientalist aesthetics. And I'm trying to create symmetry in the book. I'm trying to offer a language, a new way of talking about this kind of technology, this kind of technique that exists in the body, in a way that allows people to learn more, to build their curiosity, and to shed some of these existing, pre-existing notions of how to talk about this, because I don't use a language of East and West. So the book is an invitation. It uses Jingluo and Jingmai as an invitation. It's an invitation to explore more about Jingluo and Jingmai. There are historians who have done this, and I'm picking up where they left off.
This has been such a really wonderful conversation, and we want to sort of end it with thinking about, you know, who should read this book? Who are you hoping picks up this book?
I mean, when I wrote it, and I've rewritten this book so many times, I've started from scratch so many times, and it has been a project of trying to be clear to myself what I'm trying to say. And so I hope that anyone can really read it. Whether or not they get to different like layers of the argument, that's totally up to whoever. It's someone who, if you want images, like I was not a very, very like eager reader growing up. Like I loved images, which is why I have a book that has 70 images in it. And I pay more attention to the captions. Like you could read the book just by looking at the captions. And that's why the open access supplement with all the images in color online, it just has captions in it. You could just look at the images. There are different ways to look at these sources closely. You don't really need me to walk you through it, but I do walk you through how I see it. And so it's for graduate students, if it's like a deep dive into methodology, I'm happy to talk about that. For practitioners, if it's a way to say why nerves are insufficient, and I've had some people reach out to me to say, this makes a lot of sense. If it's for practitioners to understand why nerves are insufficient, that's great. If it's for just a lay public trying to think about, not to say that there is like a distinction between graduate students and lay people, but like people who aren't necessarily familiar with East Asian practices, if they want to just read something and just to dip their toe into it, cool. And then read the preface. Like you don't really need to get much further beyond that. Preface, conclusion. The deeper the body of the argument is I think if you want to sit with the images a bit longer and get some historical context, that's what it's there for. If you want to just look at the bibliography, like I've assembled as much as I could because I work between multiple fields. So you can read the bibliography, you can read the glossary if you want. They're just different parts of the book that allow the book to be read in different ways. So whoever picks it up, you know, just dog ear it, do whatever you want. And it's really out of my hands.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit on the different methodologies that you're bringing into this book?
That's a big question. So in my practice, because I was trained in science studies, history, and anthro, because I also work as a filmmaker, I'm very visual, because I am somewhat of an autodidact where I'm trained as a modernist, but I use classical sources. Some of the sources are in Latin, German, French, Japanese, classical, scenographic, Chinese. There's an image in Russian. Like I follow these images and every time I encounter, I have different methods depending on how proficient or improficient I am with the sources. Because I'm dealing with images, I also deal with close reading. I've reconstructed different kinds of images just to think with them. I try things out. Even when I was in my postdoc and I was in neuroscience labs, I was sectioning dorsal root ganglia in bats. And that also informed how I was thinking about peripheral sensation and nerves. I was doing epidemiological studies in peripheral neuropathy. That also helped. So I'm really capacious in how I approach both linguistic and material and visual, philological aspects, because this is so broad. Like at its heart, this is a work of cultural history. And I think of myself as a cultural historian. So I have to be capacious, but it is still requires its own kind of rigor. And of course, reading secondary sources, like reading whatever journal articles I have, doing a little bit of critical fabulation, archive work, material cultural history. So the second project will deal more with practice that follows different healers really around different parts of the world and ends with in Houston and in Haiti. So that's what I'm hoping the second project to do.
It sounds like you did a lot of improvisation yourself for this book.
Oh, for sure. And then filming and interviewing and like that's all part of the practice.
Yeah.
I hope that this is the beginning of a longer conversation. The book doesn't have to be for everybody. But I do hope that it at least has a place in a longer conversation. And I think about conversation not just as a social practice and not as, you know, this performance practice or an invitation for improvising to think with, but it is just a drop in the bucket. But if we think about when Expressiveness of the Body was published in 1999, this book published in 2025, it's, you know, 26 years between these two books. And my book is a direct response to Hisa's Expressiveness of the Body book, where he talks about the divergence of Greek and Chinese medicine. And it's not that I'm talking about convergence, picking up where he left off, both kind of topically and temporally. But I'm trying to at least play. And I hope that the book has, because maybe I hope that the integrity of the book lasts. I really do.
Yeah. So for our listeners, I just want to say, Lan, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for joining us. When you're ready to talk about the second book project, we'll be here for your third time on the podcast.
Oh my gosh. People will be like, oh no, thank you so much. Thank you both so much. This has been really great.
And just a reminder to folks, for those who are interested in reading Professor Land's book, it is free and available to download at Project Muse. Check it out.
Body Maps, Improvising Meridians and Nerves in Global Chinese Medicine from Johns Hopkins University Press. Congratulations, Lan. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.